Welcome to the Xeno Podcast, where we try to make sense of the strange. Today,
we have our friend and fellow English major, Scott Muhlstein. Did I say that right?
That's right.
Scott Muhlstein. It's a pretty complicated spelling.
It's a hard name.
Yeah, just before we started recording, we were talking about whether or not you should have a pen name.
Right.
It's a good question.
Yeah. What are like the best pen names of history?
Of history? I don't know. We were just learning in one of my classes about George Eliot. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty good pen name because she was actually a woman.
Ooh.
And
I mean, could have fooled me.
I mean, if she didn't have a pen name, maybe nobody would have even accepted her. So that's it's a good thing to think about.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Lemony Snicket.
Is that a name?
Yeah. Well, it's not his actual name. Nobody knows who he is.
Is that what it is? Like, no one knows who he is?
For the series of unfortunate events.
I mean, I always
saw it.
I guess that makes sense.
Sounds like a candy, I think.
Yeah. I think that's why he
did.
Like a gross
lemony
candy.
Snickets.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Like, want some lemony Snickets?
Might be an unfortunate event.
It has too many consonants. Just Snickets.
Snickets.
And lemony.
Snickety.
Lemony is kind of a softer sound, but then Snicket just comes through like
Snicket cricket.
It's like Snickers.
Like a lemon bar.
Snickers,
that's what it makes me think of.
Fine.
Yeah.
Snickers,
there's something about
good.
Lemony and then Snicket together.
Lemony Snickers.
That's why he picked it. It's an anomaly.
Yeah. Mark Twain.
Yep.
What is Twain? Theory. Like rope?
It's like nautical thing, right?
Yeah, he was drained on
a steamboat,
I think.
Oh yeah.
And that's how they measure the waters and they call out Mark Twain.
Mark Twain.
Yeah.
He's like, that's me.
That's me.
He's like,
yes.
What? He's like, not you.
Not yet.
Not you, Samuel Clemens.
Yeah.
Clemony Snicket.
Clemony Snicket.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, Scott is a great poet, and he's here to talk about his poems coming out in a book, I guess. You're printing it?
Yeah, I'm working on a book. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, it's called Thoughts from Yesterday.
Nice.
So it's just a compilation of poetry that I've been working on for quite a while, 3 or 4 years.
Wow. So, So you've been at it for a while.
Yeah. Like, what set you to start trying to write a poetry book? I guess, when did you start writing?
Well, initially I didn't set up to write a book at all. I just, it's funny, I used to hate poetry.
Really?
I didn't understand. I mean, like, as a little kid, like, I feel like most little kids like Dr. Seuss or like, you know, the
Sneetches.
The poem. Or some older kids. No, but like, I feel like most people like rhyming poetry like when they're kids, you know, because there's just like an initial attraction to rhyming words.
Right.
But like, after I figured out that like modern poetry doesn't rhyme, I feel like I kind of felt betrayed. You know, I was like, what is this? Like, if it's not rhyming, then it's not poetry.
It's
and
not
like,
clever.
What's the purpose of it? It's just, you know, I mean, it's just like prose, just without normal lines. And so,
so it's
I
just
used
weirdly
to hate
spaced.
It. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember I had that too for sure.
Yeah.
Like, even up until through college, I didn't really like poetry. I mean, I liked songs and lyrics, but it always would rhyme.
Right.
I remember the first thing that really changed my perspective of poetry was when we studied people like T.S. Eliot.
Yeah.
And
actually, me too.
Ezra Pound, that's his name?
Wow.
Yeah,
Pound?
Ezra Pound.
Yeah, just the craziest, like,
modern poetry.
Yeah. Yeah. It just showed, like, what you can really do with poetry.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
Yeah, actually, I got really into The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot.
That's my favorite poem.
Yeah, I love that poem.
And I think I'm actually going to write my senior paper on that one.
Oh, you should, man. It's so good.
So metal.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's kind of what brought me into liking poetry better also, is like people like T.S. Eliot. But I remember, so I didn't like poetry, and then there was this one night, I was probably like 14, 15, and I was just feeling like kind of down, and I was a little bit depressed. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like writing, and so I started writing, and this poem just came out onto the page, and it was really like old-fashioned, like old-timey poem. It kind of sounds like it's like a Tennyson style, because I don't know, I think like when you're 13, 14, like that's kind of what you think of as good poetry, at least that's what I did, you know. I was just like, I just want to sound like official, you know. So like, but I don't know, that's just what came out on the page, and I remember finishing it and feeling like, wow, like those are the emotions that I was feeling, and I was able to express them, and I didn't know if anybody else would enjoy it or anything. And sometimes still I don't know if anyone else enjoys it, but I at least I felt like, you know, like those are my emotions, and it just felt good to get them out onto the page.
Yeah. Do you still have that poem?
Yeah.
It's called Wonder. It's called Wonder Plus Sorrow. But
would you ever like put it in your book, or is it just not your style anymore?
I would have to edit it pretty thoroughly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just like a nice memorabilia. Yeah. You just have, like, it all came from this.
Yeah. Just that's like so nice. Early stuff. But
did you show it to anybody?
Yeah, I think I showed it to like my parents, mm-hmm. you know. And my parents were like, this is interesting. Like I think I grew up in Utah, and so I always kind of grew up with this feeling that like I didn't know if creative things were really valued, like, and especially I think Utah culture really values like usefulness and like taking care of your family economically.
There's a certain amount
monetarily
kind of utilitarianism, you know. So I don't know. So I always kind of felt a little bit like, this is like the direction I like to go. Like I like creative things. I like art, but I didn't know if it was something that other people would like.
So. Do you think like that attitude of not really valuing art has to do with, at least it seems like to me, it would have to do with the fact that there's so much out there already, not just in terms of classics, but in terms of modern people doing it.
That could be it.
It just discourages you, like, oh, there's just this.
And everybody can do it. Everybody can put it online.
Right.
Everybody.
Yeah.
I thought a lot about how, at least in Utah, you know, you have this whole frontier mindset, you know, that's kind of been passed down generation to generation. And, like, I mean, if you think about, like, pioneers coming to Utah, like, they probably weren't that worried about poetry, you know. Like, they were just worried about survival. And I feel like that's a lot of the case with America, like, it's a pretty new place, and so people value like what you can do with your hands, like how you can make money. But like art, I think art has been pushed to side a little bit, like because like it's like when any of us are talking to our friends and they're like, you're an English major, so like how are you,
what are you gonna do after graduation?
How are you
graduation?
Gonna survive, you know?
Yeah.
I just think there's this general mentality in America that if like, oh, like why are you doing that if you can't make money, you know?
Right.
And
well, Scotty, this brings us to the question. Why are you an English major?
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Indeed. Yes, I am an English major. A reluctant English major.
Yeah. Sure. Did you switch your major, or has it always been English?
I just didn't choose a major for a long time.
Yeah.
For like 2 years. And then I was forced into choosing a major because my advisor is like, well, you got to pick one or else we're going to kick you out. So, okay.
Yeah, very forceful.
What was it between English and?
I've always been really interested in art. So I thought about being an art major, but I knew that the art program here was focused on like realistic art. And that's not really what I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. And I also thought about doing humanities or anthropology, which I'm also really interested in. But
nice. Well, you chose the right major, Scott.
I hope so. Yeah, it's a good one.
It's a good one. So,
it's definitely not for everybody. That's a little disclaimer.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
It's a lot of
not
reading.
Not for the faint-hearted.
If you don't like reading, don't do it.
Or writing.
Yeah.
Writing research papers.
Exactly.
In particular.
I just died last night with a research paper.
Oh, man.
I have yet to write a pretty solid research paper. Solid isn't like
is real.
A block of text. Not so much like really killer. Like a good one.
Yeah. Get to write a full one, huh?
Yeah. Be rough. But it's interesting.
Yeah.
No. It's good skills. I think the best thing so far about being an English major, I think, is like just being exposed to a lot of old literature. Because I think I've always had a curiosity of like trying to get into older classic literature, but it's hard on your own, you know, like if you don't have somebody to guide you through it, to like say like, this is why this is important, this is why this makes sense. And I've found that's really helpful with the professors. So
Yeah.
That's interesting because you're so, I feel like your style is so modern.
Yeah.
How do you take inspiration from a classic or like an older poem?
Yeah, I actually, I feel like a lot of my inspiration lately has come from the Romantic poets.
Really?
Yeah. I took a class last semester from Dr. Hahn on campus, and it was English Romantic literature. And I had never really read any Romantic poetry before, but like once I started understanding like the theory behind their poetry and like how they composed it, I felt like, man, like this is me, you know, like this is I guess that's kind of because like obviously I don't know if I can measure up to the Romantics ever, but like this is like what I feel like motivates my poetry, you know, and like I can understand what these guys are saying. And like I never understood like Edgar Allan Poe's method of like carefully constructing poetry and like watching every little syllable, because like the Romantics are more focused on spontaneous feelings, and that's what I like.
Interesting. So, I mean, I guess like you're always going to be taking inspiration from other things. Like Picasso said something to the effect of like good artists imitate, great artists steal.
Yeah.
That's right. And then Banksy took that quote and he spray painted over it, and he's like, Banksy, like he like wrote his name.
It's a genius move.
I know, it's so smart. That guy's cool, or group, whatever it is.
Whatever he is or she is.
Whatever the entity of Banksy is.
Yeah.
If you're listening.
Hopefully, that'd be great. Get some viewers, some listeners. Come so who's like, who's somebody that inspires you? Like in general, doesn't have to be romantic.
Like a poet?
Yeah, sure. Or anybody, anything.
I don't know. I really, for a long time, I was really inspired by Emerson, actually. Mm-hmm. I really liked Emerson. But lately, I've started to, like I said, I really like Wordsworth, the Romantic poet. He's great. And I like his ideas about nature. I've been thinking a lot about nature and how it impacts our lives, how I was thinking a lot last semester about, you know, if you live in a city and like all you see is man-made objects, then that's what you interpret as reality. You know, you say like, okay, I'm always seeing skyscrapers, I'm always seeing chairs, I'm always seeing all these things. And like when you're looking at that, you're like, this is what the world is. You know, but that's not completely true, really. And like when you go out into nature, you say, you see, oh, this is what the world is, you know. And I think the danger in interpreting man-made objects as reality is that people are imperfect, you know, and so the things that we create are imperfect. And so when we're looking at reality that way, we're saying reality sucks, you know. Reality is this mechanical thing that is disappointing, you know. But I think when you look at nature, I believe God made nature, you know. God created nature. And so I think there's a lot that we can learn from viewing nature and realizing that that is a big part of reality, and it's a lot closer to the ideal than man-made creations. So that's what's been inspiring my poetry lately.
How do you think, like, the Emersonian versus the Wordsworthian view of nature is different? Because I have only read Emerson and his ideas on nature.
Yeah.
I haven't read any Wordsworth.
Yeah, the funny thing is I think Emerson stole a lot of ideas from Wordsworth, getting back to this, you know, artist, true artist steal. Yeah. I mean, like, I first read Emerson, you know, and Emerson is all about originality, which is the ironic thing. He's like, you know, don't listen to your forebears, you know, like, listen to the soul, you know. And but then I started reading Wordsworth, and I'm like, what the heck, like, Emerson, like, you stole this straight from Wordsworth, you know, like, Wordsworth. And then I was taking this Renaissance class this semester, and Wordsworth stole it from this other guy named Brown. He wrote this book called Religio Medici, I think. And I was reading that, and I was like, this is just the Romantics, you know, in the Renaissance. And so, I mean, I think good ideas, you know, find expression in like all times, you know. But so like when you ask like how are they different, like I think Emerson, he voices it differently, but he's saying kind of the same thing. And Emerson really does it through prose, and Wordsworth does it through poetry, which I appreciate. So
it's like archetypal criticism, basically.
Sure.
Is like where that comes from, that idea. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, be original, but if you want to have a good story, you're going to have to rely on these other things.
You're
going
to have to not be original.
There's just deep-rooted things, you know,
that we like to hear.
Come out in different forms.
Yeah. And humans are always going to respond to the same things, probably.
Yeah. I mean, like the search for truth and this, like, there is something that's mysterious about nature because we feel like we're separated from it, but if you like view people as animals, everything that we make is nature.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like, it's both something that's understandable and something that's mysterious.
Yeah, it's super interesting. It's weird also because I've also thought about how, you know, some poets like idealize nature, right? Like nature is this perfect godlike ideal like I've been talking about, you know, but like there's also a lot of bad things about nature. You know, like if you're really like watching animals, like they kill each other all the time, you know, and like it's a painful thing. Like people are always dying, animals are always dying, plants are always dying, and nature is violent, you know. Nature isn't like some peaceful ideal. I remember sitting on the beach at Hukilau, and it was like a really big wave day, and you know, like you're always told that like the ocean is peaceful and calm, you know, but then I was like, man, like the ocean is violent, you know, like
just smashing these kids.
It's like
trying to boogie board.
I think I wrote a poem actually that day, and it was like there is a line in it, I don't know if I can remember, but it's something like the ocean is wild and free, not like how God wills our souls to be, you know. But like I feel like sometimes we think that the ocean is like just this big peaceful meditative space, but like it's also pretty violent, you know, and I think that's true for a lot of nature.
Yeah, that idea for comes out in Moby Dick
and sure, that we've been reading in class.
Everything just ties into each other. Archetypal criticism is.
We should talk about that more because I'm behind, but
let's catch up.
Should I get caught up?
Should we read it during the podcast?
It's got some good passages.
No, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, it makes sense why it's so famous.
Yeah,
I'm just like, wow, this prose.
Whoa,
it's heavy.
Yeah, I really do think it's funny. I don't know if Brother Allred agreed today, but I think it is funny.
Yeah,
it's a funny book. But life is funny.
Well, I honestly forget what we were talking about. We were just like in this groove.
The groove, the nature groove.
Oh, right. It was about nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, like, why is nature, why do bad things happen? Oh, yeah. That's what I was thinking about.
Right.
So, just like the essential question of life, why do bad things happen? I've been doing some research about, like, Adam and Eve and just the value of chaos in like when people seek order.
Yeah.
So basically I wrote this paper about Hester from The Scarlet Letter.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's about how she's like Eve because they both step into chaos on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They go against the grain, they go against the laws of their people. And even though they're supposed to come either directly from God or from like the people's perception of God.
Right.
They both learn through walking into chaos.
That's true. Yeah.
So,
well,
that's why bad things happen.
Sick, tight connections there.
At least that's what I argued in the paper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. And look, I think the question is too, is like, is that God's will for chaos to happen, or is it just something that he has to work with?
That's interesting. I guess in the paper what I argued is that the serpent represented pure chaos and then God represented pure order. But since God made all the animals, he also made the serpent. So
that's the tricky thing.
It was like, you have to have chaos. Mm-hmm. And he set up this situation that was basically doomed to fail.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
yeah,
You have
well,
to.
Well, he had to. Yeah.
It's very interesting. But yeah,
it was like a mark of courage for Eve to be like, I saw that the fruit was good and I wanted the knowledge. So mm-hmm. she basically trades sin and death for knowledge.
She yeah. steps into it.
Yeah. It's like on purpose. Yeah.
That's the weird thing.
Same thing as Hester.
Yeah, we're also reading Paradise Lost in my Renaissance class, and that talks about that a lot, you know, because it's all about Adam and Eve. And, I mean, there's one view of viewing Eve as, like, the biggest idiot in all of humanity, like, bringing all humanity on us. But then there's the other alternative view of, you know, she brought everything good
yeah.
about humanity, you know. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, the good comes from the bad.
Mm-hmm. A little Taoism.
in there. Everything's tied into each other. Yeah, yeah. Chaos and order. Everything yeah. is mm-hmm. tied together. That's the like the white and the black paisley,
yeah, the white and,
the black and like the white paisley.
Right.
They're intertwined.
Yeah, I'm actually trying to find this poem. I wish my it's on my iPad, but my iPad's dead. But I just wrote a poem about this topic. It's about contradiction, mm-hmm. and. Hopefully, does the internet not work in here? I don't know, but
I've been struggling with the internet this week.
I don't know. So, yeah, it's yeah. been coming in and going in pockets.
Yeah. Anyway, at the end of the poem, I just say, contradiction is the universe's habit, you know? Mm-hmm. And the poem is about how, you know, like, at first we want to cling to good, you know, we just want our lives to be good. But I think that if we embrace the contradiction, then life is a lot more enjoyable. And so that's what it's about. And I think God, I mean, everything's present before God, and so, like, God is clearly aware of the contradiction, and he lets it go on, you know. And so I think it's interesting to think of all the bad things in the world are allowed to go on because of God, and, like, what does that make of God's character, you know? Like, mm-hmm. He must value what the bad can teach us enough to let it go on, you know? And I don't know if I could get myself to that point, you know? But
what do you mean get yourself to that point?
Well, I mean, if I was God, I guess. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if, like, I could get to a point where I feel like, yeah, like, it's worth, the Holocaust is worth it, mm-hmm. you know? Like, the Holocaust is worth what it can teach humanity, you know, or right. something like that. Like, God's mindset must be, like, much bigger,
higher,
better yeah. than ours, you know, if that's the case. And I don't know. I think that's one of the mysterious things about God.
Do you have any poems that address this besides the contradiction one?
I have this one I just wrote. It kind of contradicts it. It has a little bit of that biblical metaphor in it.
Archetypes.
So I could read it if,
yeah.
Yeah,
if you guys want to.
Absolutely.
I wrote it the other day, and, like, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I write best when I'm really hungry.
You're tapping into your primal self.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know what it
flight.
Is.
Must write.
It's like my brain just, like, turns on, you know? I think
yeah.
it's funny, like, through all cultures there's fasting, you know, and people feel like they can reach some sort of higher mental state, and I feel like when I'm just, like, starving student, sometimes I write better poetry, so I don't know what it is, but
maybe it's just from a really okay I am not into anatomy but
when or English majors
pull
here,
in some
people.
Biology majors here,
but maybe it's like when you are not eating, your blood that would go to your stomach
right.
is, like, just focused on everything else
for
and
sure.
it's not trying to digest, because if you're always eating and you're never taking a break, like, your stomach's always going, so maybe
yeah.
it's just
yeah.
you're letting your stomach take a week off, which
yeah.
can be a long time.
Sure.
off.
Yeah, I've also thought about, like, what if you're, like, you know, a hunter-gatherer or something, and, like, you're starving, like, clearly you need to have your full mental capacities to find your food. Maybe that's it.
That makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, you're quicker.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. But,
one of those things might be true.
Yeah, we don't know.
Mate.
Just speculation.
We're just English majors.
Yeah,
just speculating
majors.
About the body.
That's pretty much what being an English major is. It's
yeah,
like, this
just
might be true.
Speculation. I can't put my finger on it, but this might be true.
Here's some proof.
Here's
yeah.
some
but
proof that other people have
decide.
Said, but they're also saying it might be true. Yeah. It's my research paper today.
It's all about the search. It's the journey, you know? Yeah. You can't just, like, attain it.
That's right. It'd be too easy. Yeah, so I'll read this. So I don't have a title, but it's called... But the first line is, well, bulbous. So yeah. And also, just a little disclaimer, I don't really like reading my own poetry. I feel like...
Carly, read it.
Yeah, you can read it, Carly.
I can read it, but...
Well, I feel like you'll have the emphasis, like,
yeah,
better, like,
yeah, maybe. I don't know.
I haven't read these before, so.
Maybe if we read one more, you can read the other one.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I just feel like my poems, like, a lot of them have different voices, and I don't feel like they're always my own voice, I guess. It's like when you're writing a play, and, like, you have a bunch of different characters, you know, they're all different voices, and so I don't know if my voice is fitting to all of them. Anyway. But, actually, yeah, do you want to read it?
Sure. I will sure try. I have never, like, read poetry publicly.
Oh, that's fine.
Oh, it's going out to the people.
I know. It's exciting. Okay. Well, the bulbous sylvian intensity of nature's forms alleviates the suffering of my early youth. That dry, dull dirge that sat at the back of my throat. Alleviated by Eden's pouring syrup and God's wicked bounty. Why is this? Is it really as clean and pure and slick? I think it appears alive. Doesn't it appear alive? I feel more brotherhood with the snake on its slimy sides, the machina with its fallow hides. It seems a wicked destiny awaits me. For I love the works of sense and the vile forms of God. And I see a heavens that's more immense even than this rapturous sod.
Yeah.
Sorry, is there more?
No, that's it.
Oh, okay, cool. I was trying to scroll. Here.
Yeah, thanks.
That's awesome.
Yeah, thanks for reading that.
Look at the sounds. Wow. Yeah, it sounds cool.
Yeah.
Thanks. When you write, do you have... Like, do you try to pay attention to the sound, or are you just trying to get your ideas?
Yeah, I definitely pay attention to the sound.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's kind of what distinguishes poetry from prose, is the way the words sound, and, mm-hmm. like, the rhythm. And so I always try to pay attention to, like, this is weird, but kind of, like, how it makes my... Or how it makes, like, my mouth feel. Like,
how
you know, like, how it makes your lips feel, like, the actual physical motion of saying the words.
Lemony Snickets.
I like that line about the syrup.
Yeah.
Will you read that again? I don't know. It's
like... Yeah. Alleviated by Eden's pouring syrup.
Wow.
And God's wicked bounty.
Wow.
Yeah, so with this poem, I was thinking a lot about, like, you know, I mean, God made the world, you know, and the world is pretty sensual, you know, at least in my opinion. Like,
right.
I think, like, all of nature is pretty sensual, and, like, God made it, and, like, coming from a Christian perspective, like, we see sensual things as wicked and evil sometimes, you know, but I feel like there's a lot of goodness in the sensual side of nature, I guess.
Yeah, so. And it depends. Like, what are you defining sensual as?
Yeah.
Well,
like,
I mean,
the senses.
I don't know. Like, I feel like even the plants here in Hawaii, you know, like, the very, like, slick, like, oily plants, like, feel and seem very sensual to me. Like, and like, very fertile, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like, I would say that everything... At least our world is very sensational. You know,
sure,
like, everything comes from, like, a sense. Like,
yeah,
you can...
Perception. Yeah.
You, like, the way you perceive it. And basically, if God made it that way, like, it has to be able to be perceived by one of our five senses.
Sure.
Right.
Or six, maybe we haven't tapped into yet. But
yeah.
Or maybe more.
I was thinking about this earlier today, actually. This is so relevant. I don't even know why. How did this happen? But just the, like, the order that God creates the world... in, it's basically like he's moving through levels of consciousness of biological things. So, like, if you can separate the light from the dark, like, if you would be like an organism, like a tiny little, like, microorganism that has just like a little eye spot that can see like light and dark.
Right.
And then after that, it's, I don't know, like the land from the sea.
Oh, you mean just like in Genesis? The order he does it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's basically he's moving through levels of consciousness, and then it ends with human. So yeah, he goes through like the land and the water, and then that's like, you know, like people started in the, or like people like who believe in evolution.
Right.
Like it's not really believe in evolution. Evolution holds that things started in water, they came on land.
Sure. No, I've actually thought a lot about that with Genesis because, you know, like as a Mormon, you think about evolution, you know,
right.
And you read Genesis and it's interesting that the way, like you say, that God created things is kind of the same order as evolution. You know, it starts with very basic things. I think it might even start with insects. I don't know. I can't remember. But it definitely starts at the beginning with fish.
Yeah.
And then it goes up, beasts and then humans, you know.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's just like a big
there's probably a connection
metaphor there. For evolution.
Yeah. I don't think that religion and evolution are incompatible. No, like a
I
lot of people think oh, it's no, like incompatible, but
right. No, definitely not.
I think that could definitely be an explanation. People. You know, people thought that we came from things that could just see light and dark and then came through.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of like just like saying I don't think religion and reality are incompatible. I mean, like, we can see evolution happening, you know.
Yeah. And even after that, we were just regular people, you know. We were some early primate type thing, but then something happened, like we ate an apple, and then we just like changed,
we became
self-conscious, you know.
Yeah.
Because
they
realize that they're naked, so at some point
that's a level of new consciousness.
Yeah, it's like they
it's a big consciousness leap. Oh, I'm naked.
Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some old wisdom packed into those short verses.
Wow. Didn't know I was getting what I was getting myself
deep into.
Into
the theology today.
Today. I know, that's awesome though. Do you have any more poems you want to share with us? Maybe from your book?
Sure, yeah. You guys read some of these.
Yeah. Yeah. Loved all of them.
I could read this one, the blacktop one. Blacktop.
Down.
This one's a lot different than that one I just read. It's very much about society and government and the state of our world. And so it's not about nature. This was before I got into the romantics. So.
That's okay.
It's more, maybe even more T.S. Eliot-esque.
It was when you were in the world and your whole perception was man-made perception.
Yeah, that's right.
What are these machines?
I was confused. No, this poem is interesting because when I wrote it, I feel like it's one of those where it just all flowed out, you know? And I remember after I wrote it, I was like, I don't like this poem at all. This sucks. And I actually remember talking on the phone with my mom and being like, I just wrote this poem and like, I don't like it. It's just really terrible. I remember I thought about like just deleting it. And, but I didn't. And it's weird to me because I feel like writing it, I tapped into some weird awareness I had of like what was going around me, like in the news and stuff. And it was weird this past election. I was thinking about Donald Trump, like we're all thinking about Hillary Clinton. And I feel like some lines from this are applicable to that election, which is weird. I don't know what that means, but.
When did you write this?
I wrote this, I think 2014.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, quite a while ago. But I'll read it. And just a little clarification. I use this symbol in this poem of tabletop sinks, and it refers to parenthood. So.
Okay.
And specifically motherhood. And that might sound a little bit sexist, maybe, to associate motherhood with tabletop sinks, but I mean it in the best way, I guess. So.
All good intentions.
Anyways. Yep. Blacktop. The world is a dark blacktop street with a store and poison concrete sun, sand and cactus gardens with sign paint that peels off, old hotel on the corner, nobody listens for the sound it makes. Who would listen for the sound it makes? Like the call of a jackal or a wolf howling at the peeling moon. The moon peels like the sun. The sun peels the paint and nobody knows where and how tabletop sinks play the part of defining moralists at play with the progress of the nation. And it's people who do not care anymore, whether murderers or plagiarists, seek the position of defining office. And those offices in shambles due to lack of integrity stirred by the pot of jealousy, want, need, and greed, which calls itself progress. But we know that progress comes from tabletop sinks. We know that progress comes from the home of those minds wandering in the dark of the back alley street, in the bag of the leg raised to ward off the predators of justice, to ward off all that is good. What is good if not tabletop sinks? Who is good now anyway? Who's to say if the sun comes up when it has never fallen down? And who's to say the moon never called the sun up for a party that went wrong and left the world lost? Who's to say when turquoise paint leaves the town for a bar and a drink and some baseboards that don't mean much? But God is in his church and he's calling, like a jackal or a wolf, and the soundproof walls of the church have the populace in disrepair and agony in a predicament so steep that nothing short of a jackknife and a colored sword of truth could save them. But those are in the garbage bin, and nobody looks in the bin when it's already full of tortillas and old broken bottles, of painted towns and deadbeat fathers and misplaced education. Save the bottles. Throw them away. And the world will become as bright as if the sun had never fallen. Shout the diseased. Shout the diseased. I kind of messed up that last line.
Oh, I loved it.
Wow. Yeah, thanks.
That was my favorite one of the poems that I read from your book. I guess your soon-to-be book.
Yeah.
How come?
It just was interesting. Like, it was so many different ideas. And honestly, I am not 100% sure about what you intended everything to mean. But I guess no one really can be. But just the way that you, I don't know, compare the different forces of society, the way that you look at them, it's a... And with the tabletop sinks, I didn't relate it to parenthood, but sure. I just thought it was something that amongst all these like big forces, you have just like this little thing, you know?
Yeah, it's a
just
simple thing.
Yeah, simple. Mm-hmm. Thought that was a good juxtaposition.
Yeah.
And I really do think that simple things are what maintain our civilization. You know, it's what keeps our civilization in check. Good people and good families, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good old values.
Yeah. Good old values, I guess.
Family values. No, that's awesome.
What's up with the last line?
Shout the diseased.
Yeah.
I think for me it's an acknowledgement of my own ignorance, you know. I mean the poem is kind of in my voice, and I'm saying this is the way that society could be fixed. You know, but it's coming from a diseased person, you know. It's coming from somebody that's also in society and is also not free from society's sickness, you know. So I'm not completely trustworthy, I guess.
Yeah. No one's above it. Everybody's in it.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why we can't fix it? Because we're all inside of it?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a big part of it. Yeah. I think that's why it's important to go to nature.
Is that a big theme in your collection of poems? Or do you even have a theme, or is it just pure Scott?
I don't know. I think if there is a theme, it is thoughts from yesterday, you know, thoughts from my past 4 years, you know, what's been on my mind. I don't know if that's a good enough theme.
Yeah, absolutely. It's your theme.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, talking about these ideas has been really interesting. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the actual process of you writing.
Yeah.
Sure.
Because I feel like a lot of people, I mean, how long have you been writing in general? So since you're 13, so?
I think it's probably 14, 15. I don't know.
It's like?
2011, probably.
2011.
So that's what?
Wow, yeah.
6 years ago.
It's a lot of time.
Yeah. So where do you draw inspiration from, just besides, you know, thoughts of yesterday, just stuff you think about walking around town?
Yeah, honestly.
Bobbing downtown.
I don't know. I think it depends on when I'm talking about, because different times, periods in my life, I feel like I draw inspiration from different things, I guess. Lately, I feel like I've drawn a lot of inspiration from things I've read, you know, other ideas. But a while ago, I tried to, my main purpose in poetry, my poetry was to kind of excavate my mind and like excavate my subconscious. And so that was my purpose and my inspiration for a long time. So it was a lot of like inward focus, you know. And then, I mean, before that and during that time, I was also influenced, like with this last poem, by, you know, current events and like the news and the things that swirl around us, you know, all the time. And so, yeah, I think it depends on the time period.
Do you try to write every day? Is it more like trying to get everything down? Or are you just like, oh, this is a gold nugget, you know, of an idea?
I think especially with poetry, it's important to not force yourself into poetry. I think with novel writing and stuff like that, and like obviously research papers,
you gotta force
yourself to the grindstone, you know. But I think there's something about poetry that like really good poetry really does come from inspiration. And when your thoughts are all kind of like, when they all congeal into something and you just feel like you need to put it down, at least for me, that's how it is, you know, like I don't feel like I write very good poetry when I sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write a poetry about racism and this is how it's going to go, you know. But if maybe I'd been thinking about racism during the week and like I, after a long time of thinking about it, I sit down and I feel like writing about it, then I will.
You just watch Zootopia?
Yeah, that really would get me going. Yeah. I like Zootopia, actually. It's a good movie.
Okay.
That's cool. So when you get discouraged with writing, you just stop, discouraged.
You get disturbed.
I mean,
I get discouraged.
Yeah. Like any advice for people out there just trying to put together their own collection of poems?
Yeah, I think for a long time I was really worried that like, I think once I started writing poetry, I got worried that I would just lose it, you know? Like, I would just lose the desire to write and lose any ability that I do have. And so, and I'm kind of paranoid about those kinds of things. I'm, like, always kind of worried that, like, my life is going to change, I guess. And so, like...
Well, spoiler alert, it is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bummer, huh? But, yeah, so in the past, yeah, I've been worried that, like, I would lose my ability to write, and like sometimes I would get discouraged, like, oh, like I have no inspiration. But I think the biggest thing that's helped me is, I don't know if somebody told me this or what, but like if I don't know what to write, then I just write about not knowing what to write. Like,
yeah, you write about writer's block.
Yeah, I just write about writer's block, you know, and that seems to help.
Yeah, so you get into like, why is this happening? Just gets into like your consciousness. And
yeah,
absolutely.
So then it's less about just like writing about a certain thing, and it's just about writing about what you're feeling. Like if you're feeling like, oh, I'm too discouraged to write, write about being discouraged to write, and then
you're like, all right.
Yeah. Would you say it's fair to say, like, the best poetry comes from like tapping into like the ether, like just the inspiration that comes. And then, like, when you revise, that's when you really bring, like, the grindstone, like...
Yeah, so I think, like I was saying earlier, like, for me, it really comes back to the romantics. Like, William Wordsworth had this idea where, you know, poetry is, like, inspiration recollected... Oh, I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's, like, something like inspiration recollected in tranquility. So, like, he would, you know, go out into nature and, like, feel a lot of emotion, you know? But he wouldn't write the poem right then necessarily. Like maybe later in his life, he would write about that feeling, you know, and recollect and kind of like compose it into like a synthetic whole, or a, not synthetic, like a cohesive whole, you know? And like, I think for me, like, I'll write when I'm inspired, you know, but, and when I feel like it's coming from somewhere else, like I guess, from the ether, I guess, but like, but, and I think that is really important to write like that. But I also think that if you just leave it like that, it's going to be pretty like messy and like terrible most of the time. I think rarely you get a poem that's completely finished just after that first inspiration, but sometimes I think you do. Like this one, Blacktop, was pretty close. But I think there's a lot of value in going back after that initial burst of inspiration and like trimming it, manicuring it, you know, just making it flow better, fixing the rhythm, fixing the specific words. Like that poem I just read you guys today about nature and sensual things, like I couldn't think of a word in there when I first wrote it, and so I just put a placeholder word in there, you know. But I knew what I wanted to convey, but I just couldn't think of the word for it. And so I think there's a lot of value in, like, after the initial inspiration, manicuring it into something that's more beautiful and flows better.
How long do you let those pieces sit? Like, you know how you write something down, you're like, okay, this is awesome, I'm happy with it, but I know I gotta revise it. Like, how long do you let that sit? Or do you have
I mean, it depends. I mean, that's what's so hard about, like, compiling a book, you know, because, like, I feel like even though I do revise something to something that I like, I feel like it's not exactly
right,
you know. I listened to this podcast about artists a while back. I think it was Malcolm Gladwell, but he's talking about different kind of artists. Some artists that, you know, they are always tinkering with their artwork, you know, they're never finished with their painting or whatever. And then there's other kinds of artists that will just have flashes and be done, you know. And I think I probably tend towards the tinkering, tinkering side. And so
always fixing.
And like I was just looking back at some poems that I wrote a long time ago, like 3 years ago, and most of them are crap, you know, most of them are really bad. And then, but I found like two or three where I was like, I like these, but I'm going to edit them, you know, and change them and like make them flow better.
So basically you just wait until you feel like you should go back to it.
I mean, yeah,
I don't have a set rule. In other words.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's
cool. Yeah. It's not a machine. It's poetry.
Yeah. It's poetry. I mean, I don't ever want to feel like I have to do poetry.
Right. Yeah.
So
it's fun.
Yeah.
For you.
It's enjoyable. Yeah.
Is that why you decided? You just woke up one day, you're like, this would be cool as a book, like, as a collection.
I was actually thinking a lot about how I don't like digital things.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, I don't trust digital things.
True English major form?
Yeah.
You Luddite?
Yeah. Complete Luddite. I'm like, I don't know.
We're using microphones right now.
Yeah, sorry.
It's all good.
Should record this on a piece of paper.
just a transcript.
Shorthand.
For all you fellow Luddites out there. No. What was I saying?
How did you,
don't
you
trust
I guess
technology?
Yeah, technology. No.
Printing a book.
I had a computer a while back and I was stupid and I took it to the beach.
Oh,
and that's
a
very stupid idea, you know. And like
Almost always,
probably. And it got wet. It's a terrible, terrible situation. And I lost a lot of stuff, you know. And so there's something about, for me, just having something printed out where I can feel like, well, if the digital version is corrupted, then at least I have the print version. If the print version, like, catches fire, at least I have the digital version.
Right.
So it's more, like, for myself. I don't know, like, I would love it, like, if other people read my poetry. And I feel like I write with the purpose of other people reading. But I don't know. I don't know if people are that interested in poetry these days in general. So I hope so. Yeah.
Very cool.
You can get them interested with your book.
What's your experience with publishing things before? I mean, I guess, like, what's your plan for publishing it? You just want to print a book and give it to people?
Yeah, so, I mean, I have had two poems published in, like, little literary journals, and so there's that. But,
this is a little offhand. This is that.
Yeah, there's that. No, I'm so offhand about it, because it's, like, one of them was in Kathmandu. Like, I don't know who's reading literature in Kathmandu. Maybe some monk is, like, loving my poem up in the...
Where's Kathmandu?
It's, like, in Nepal.
Yeah.
Dude, what if they're, like, using it as, like, a spiritual ritual?
Super inspired.
We gotta find this guy.
Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Probably not.
That's probably an ignorant thing to say. I don't know anything about
Yeah, sorry. That's probably some sort of racism in there.
No, they love it. I'm sure they love your poem.
Yeah, maybe to be honest, for publicity. I love Buddhist monks, so there's I have nothing against them. But yeah, so I mean, I've tried that direction before, but with this, I just wanted to print out a book and have it for myself first, you know, so I could leaf through it with my own hands and then see like how it flows, just like a little rough draft print, you know. And then once I think I'll show it to some other people and see like how they think it works, you know, what they would do. Mm-hmm. And then once I get it how I want it to be, then I would think about, you know, peddling it out to publishers.
Peddling it.
Yeah. Awesome. Publish my stuff.
Little market sample. And then
it's taking it sure. On a resume.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Awesome.
All right, any other things you want to go over?
I do want to say one thing that in an attempt to make poetry palatable to other people, I got really into like folk music, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's also a big part of my writing now. Like I try to write music too, and I think it's an interesting facet of poetry and poetic composition. I don't know why I wanted to bring that up, but just a little plug that I think folk music can be poetry too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, lyrics have always been.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Poetry.
Yeah.
Bible verses.
Mm-hmm. Psalms.
Lyric.
Songs.
Yeah. All right. Well, very cool. This has been a good time.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on and
being on the English
us.
Vortex.
Yes. Yeah.
Sorry for chatting so much.
No. Where can the people follow you? Like,
around the halls.
So if you guys fly out to Laie, Hawaii.
No, I actually didn't have a phone until, I'm a real Luddite. I didn't have a phone until yesterday. But
wow. Oh my goodness.
I mean, I
fresh
did a few months
market.
Ago. I smashed it. But yeah, so I suppose maybe Instagram.
Okay.
Scott_Russell. I think there's a lot of underscores under the... I can't remember, but you can try to find me.
Or just come find his book.
Yeah.
You can come find there.
Me. Well, maybe thoughts, don't find me in person because he's
thoughts
scary.
For yesterday? Thoughts of yesterday?
Thoughts from yesterday.
Oh, those prepositions.
Come on.
Thoughts of.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thoughts from yesterday.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
No, it's been great.
Fun stuff.
It's a privilege.
It's fun. It's a privilege. Thanks for tuning in. This was the Zeno Podcast. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Zeno Podcast.
That's XENO Podcast. If you have any questions or comments about what we talked about today or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at podcastzeno@gmail.com.
This podcast was brought to you by BYU Hawaii's Reading and Writing Center. Thanks for learning by listening.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.